The headlines: Russia says Ukraine has launched more than 10 drones on the Crimean Peninsula, as Kiev reports widespread Russian drone strikes. Gunman kills at least 9 people and wounds 7 others at a busy mall north of Dallas in the U.S. state of Texas. And the Israeli military's blockade of the occupied West Bank city of Ariha enters its third week. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mnews. Thanks for joining us. There seems to be no end in sight for the war in Ukraine, as Kiev and Moscow launched new drone attacks against each other. The cities of Sevastopol and Sakha in Crimea were targeted by 10 drone strikes. Russia has several air bases in the area, but local officials said there was no damage. Over the past week, at least 5 Russian fuel facilities close to Ukraine's borders and in Crimea have suffered similar attacks, and 2 more drones crashed on the Kremlin roof. Meanwhile, Russia has also launched widespread drone strikes on Ukraine, including on the capital, Kiev. Ukrainian officials say 2/3 of the country were targeted. No casualties have been reported. A correspondent to Moscow, Johnny Miller, tells us about the latest developments in the war in Ukraine.
Russia continuing to strike Ukraine. Also, a worrying story of Russia announcing evacuations of civilians in the Zaporozhye region. Now, it's not clear whether this is due to concerns over the nuclear power plant there, or due to concerns of shelling, or due to concerns that Ukraine may have some success in the counteroffensive. So that's an important developing story, and that's the kind of the shadow that's overhanging this war at the moment of this Ukrainian counteroffensive. It's been expected for months. Increasing signs that it may well start, but also comments from both sides. One comment from a Ukrainian general recently trying to downplay the West's hope of huge success in this counteroffensive. So very much both sides at the moment, I think, apprehensive about this counteroffensive starting. And I think many of the strikes that we're seeing from both sides are in relation to preparing or trying to counter this counteroffensive.
EU leaders sign off on a 1 billion euro ammunition package for Ukraine Friday, despite growing financial hardship for citizens throughout the 27-country bloc. A 7th consecutive hike in interest rates has been confirmed by the European Central Bank. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages will soon start paying back even more, following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by 0.25%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.
So we are talking about a 1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Economists say because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience, or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
UK police have drawn condemnations for the arrest of dozens of people on the day of the coronation of King Charles. Several British lawmakers and human rights groups have criticized the police approach. It came after police forces detained more than 50 people, including leading members of the anti-monarchy group Republic. Rights groups have labeled the arrests incredibly alarming and a dangerous precedent. According to the police, the people were held for alleged affray, public order offenses, and breach of peace. The arrest came days after the government granted new anti-protest powers to the police forces.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state, because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested, and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know? Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why there are many mainstream platforms. So what the royal family stand for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises, could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
There's been another mass shooting in the U.S. At least 9 people have been killed and 7 others injured by a gunman at a busy mall in Dallas, Texas. The gunman, whom authorities said they believe acted alone, was also killed by the police. To get more details on how the shooting played out, we were earlier joined by our Washington correspondent Colin Campbell.
Police arrived on the scene at about 6:15 local time because they were answering another call. When they heard the shots ring out, they responded with gunfire, killing the gunman after shots had already been fired. They responded fairly quickly, and this happened in Allen, Texas, about 50 kilometers from Dallas. It's about 50 kilometers north of Dallas. And of course, this is not the first time we've seen gun violence happen in Texas. With a very relaxed carrying policy, there were a lot of predictions that we would see gun violence in Texas, and this just happens to be one of the latest incidents as the U.S. climbs towards 200 in the number of mass shootings since the beginning of the year. Highest incidences of mass shootings since the beginning of the year in the past several years, and we've seen a different number of gun policies change where they become more relaxed, not just states like Texas, but also in Florida and other states where they have open carry laws or permitless carry laws. And this means that people have easier access to guns. They can carry their guns in the open. They don't have to apply for a permit necessarily. And of course, this just makes the situation where people resort to using a gun for a means of conflict resolution or any type of dispute resolution, it's a lot easier to access that gun because the laws are a lot easier on gun owners and their access to them.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says the U.S. has suffered a humiliating defeat in its maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Raisi made the comment in an address to the fifth export potential exhibition of Iran. The president said the country has achieved progress despite sanctions and threats. Raisi said Iranian scientists and industrialists have achieved anything that was banned under the sanctions. He added that economic operators have also circumvented and offset the sanctions regime. The president also talked about the negotiations on the removal of anti-Iran sanctions imposed following the U.S. withdrawal of the 2015 nuclear deal. He said that Tehran has never abandoned the talks, but is not tying the national economy and growth to the political process. The Israeli military's blockade of the occupied West Bank city of Ariha is now in its third week. Local media say military checkpoints have been set up by the Israeli army at all the main entrances to the ancient city, also known as Jericho. Israeli forces inspect any vehicle traffic, search Palestinian passengers, and perform identity checks. The city and the adjacent Aqaba Jaber refugee camp have also been or seen deadly Israeli raids in recent weeks. Since the beginning of this year, at least 9 Palestinians have been killed and scores of others injured and arrested by Israeli forces in the city. Mona Condillo is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah. Tell us why they have zoomed in on this particular city, Mona, which has been now, in a sense, under their siege for 3 days.
In the last few months, clashes had been taking place in between Palestinians from the city of Ariha and specifically from the Aqaba Jaber refugee camp and Israeli forces. This is new for the Israelis that this specific area, Ariha, and the surrounding areas, mainly the Aqaba Jaber refugee camp, to witness clashes between the Israeli forces and the Palestinians. At least 10 Palestinians had been killed by the Israeli soldiers in Aqaba Jaber and Ariha. That's why the Israelis set military checkpoints at the entrances to Ariha and completely closed the Aqaba Jaber refugee camp, preventing people from entering or leaving the refugee camp. We have to mention that this closure, of course, had caused the Palestinians millions of U.S. dollars losses, mainly in the agricultural sector. On Wednesday, the head of Ariha's Chamber of Commerce and Industry said that the losses to tourism sector as well had amounted to some 70 million shekels with the closure of hotels, restaurants, especially that Ariha is a tourist city, and Palestinians, foreigners, Palestinians living in the lands occupied in 1948 come to this city, especially in this season as well. We have to mention something that last month, Israeli military arrested in Ariha a Jordanian lawmaker, and they claimed that he had with him that he had been smuggling weapons from Jordan to the occupied West Bank, mainly to Aqaba Jaber. He was arrested, and the Israeli military claimed that he had with him at least 200 rifles inside his own vehicle. He was arrested. Only today, Israelis decided after, contacts between Jordan and the Israeli regime, they decided to release legislator Imad Al-Adwan. However, he would be prosecuted in Jordan. And at the same time, the Israeli military decided to start removing the checkpoints surrounding Arriha and Aqab al-Jabal. We can't tell if it's one of the reasons why the Israelis have tightened the grip on Arriha and Aqab al-Jabal, but the northern entrance to Arriha is still completely closed, and Palestinians are not allowed to enter Arriha through the northern entrance to the city. However, as we are receiving now, the Israeli military started to remove the barriers and checkpoints from the other entrances to the city of Arriha and Aqab al-Jabal.
Thank you very much for that. Mona Kandil there from Occupied Ramallah. Thank you, Mona. The Israeli regime continues with its atrocities against Palestinians. An Israeli settler has shot dead a Palestinian teenager near the city of Afola. 19-year-old Diyar Omari succumbed to his wounds shortly after he was shot. No additional details are available about the incident. Earlier on Saturday, a funeral procession was held for two young Palestinians killed by Israeli forces during a raid on a refugee camp near the city of Tulkarm in the occupied West Bank. The two Palestinians were in their 20s. The latest Israeli violence brings the total number of Palestinians killed by the regime in the West Bank area this year to 111. Around 20 of the victims are under 18 years old. Saturday's killings come amid rising tensions in the occupied territories, where Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians. Tens of thousands of demonstrators have taken to the streets of Tel Aviv and other cities across the occupied territories, protesting against the Israeli cabinet's judicial reforms. Israeli media estimated 110,000 people demonstrated in Tel Aviv alone. People chanted slogans and waved flags, while some called the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, a dictator and his cabinet a fascist. Mass rallies continued to be held, despite Netanyahu putting the controversial reforms on hold, after opponents organized some of the biggest street protests ever witnessed in Tel Aviv and across the occupied territories. Israelis have been holding these rallies for 18 consecutive weeks since the judicial overhaul plan was presented in January. The reforms would give the Israeli cabinet greater control over the judiciary. Critics say that it will remove vital checks and balances and hand unchecked power to the government. Fighting shows no signs of letting up in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, as warring parties are in Saudi Arabia for talks to bring an end to the three-week-old conflict. The U.S.-Saudi initiative is an attempt to end violence between the army and paramilitary forces. The fighting has derailed an internationally backed plan to usher in civilian rule following years of unrest and uprisings. Battles since mid-April have killed hundreds of people and wounded thousands. The conflict has also disrupted aid supplies, sending around 100,000 refugees fleeing abroad. While mediators are seeking a path to peace, both sides have made it clear that they would only discuss a humanitarian truce, not negotiate an end to the war. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shmanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday of spring, May 7th, 2023. I'm Atefe Erfani hosting this program today. As you may know, Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views and attitudes are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. And if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. As I always say, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. So please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back, everyone. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program. And here we've received reception reports from around the world, from Stumo Huang from Indonesia, Najmuddin from Bangladesh, and Dilip Kumar from India, one of our old and regular listeners. So, Dilip Kumar, Stumo Huang, and Najmuddin, thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And here we have piles of letters and emails from around the world, which I mentioned some of your names here. And later during the program, I will read your great emails. Najmuddin from India has sent us an email. Najmuddin is one of our old and regular listeners. Ding Lu from China has sent us a piece of email. Hector Fria Jofre, one of our old and regular listeners from Chile, has sent us an email. From India again, we've received an email from one of our regular listeners, from Jayanta Chakrabarty. And from Poland, we have an email from Tomasz Katas. Stay with us, please. I will be back with these great emails. Welcome back. So, as I said, Najmuddin from India has sent us a piece of email. And Najmuddin says, "Dear Sir or Madam, Assalamu alaikum. Please find the reception report enclosed to this email. I heard news and news highlights program, which is always my favorite. Kindly send me new program and frequency schedule. Printed QSL card with IRIB souvenirs. Thank you." Salam and warm greetings to you, Najmuddin from India, and thank you very much for this email. Thank you for letting us know your opinion about our programs, as you mentioned that your favorites are the news section and the news highlights program. It's good to hear that. And as for your request for sending you the new program and frequency schedule, as well as the printed QSL card with IRB souvenirs, as I have always said, sending any material on behalf of IRB English Radio is halted temporarily due to the coronavirus pandemic around the world. So for the time being, please accept our eQSL or electronic QSL as verification. Maybe in the near future, we will send you IRIB English Radio souvenirs. And also, you can find the new program and frequency schedule at our website at parstoday.ir/en. Najmuddin from India, we wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And Ding Lu from China has sent us an email. Ding Lu says, "Dear IRIB, Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, I am a listener from China. Today I received your English program, Signal at 1520 1620 UTC, the signal is very strong. The listening effect is very clear. Here, I want to apply for a QSL card from the Radio Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. If there are souvenirs with Radio Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's logo, it would be even better. Through your 24-hour English broadcast, I have a deeper understanding of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I would also love to have time to travel to Iran, taste local specialties, and visit local places of interest. I hope you can send me a QSL card. Thank you. Looking forward to receiving your reply. Thanks. Best wishes. Ding Lu from China. Salam and greetings from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And appreciations to you for this great email. And appreciations to you for your constant support and commitment to IRB English Radio. It's good to hear that you have gained a great pile of conception, a deep understanding, a true understanding of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's good to hear that. So, Ding Lu from China, thank you again for this great email. We also invite you to travel to Iran and visit the great cities and villages of this great country, taste local specialties, and be acquainted with the customs and traditions of Iranian people, and many other things, many other beautiful things about Iran. Thank you again, Ding Lu from China. Please accept our electronic QSL as verification. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. So after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. So from Chile, we've received an email from Hector Fria Jofre, one of our old and regular listeners. Hector says, "Dear friends of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, I send my greetings and also a report in audio enclosed to my email confirming that I have been a listener of your radio. I would like to receive information about your country, and I certainly want to obtain a QSL card or EQSL if it would be possible, yours truly. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, Hector Fria Jofre from Chile, and warm gratitude to you for this great email. Thank you for this email and the audio you enclosed to your email confirming that you have been a listener of IRIB English Radio. So please accept our electronic QSL as verification. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon." And here we've received an email from India from Jayanta Chakrabarty, one of our old and regular listeners. Jayanta says, "Dear staff, as a long-time regular listener to my favorite radio station, I send my greetings and good wishes to IRIB English Radio team for presenting attractive and interesting programs that truly enhances my knowledge of the great nation of Iran. Please receive my feedback of one of your broadcasts, which I accessed in the 25-meter shortwave band. Reception quality was fairly good with a strong signal strength. Presentation of program was cheerful and friendly. It would be a pleasure to have my report verified at your end with a printed QSL card. I would be delighted to receive some Iranian postage stamps for collection if it is possible from your end. Wishing all at IRIB English Radio good health and safety with warm regards from India. Salam and warm greetings and warm regards from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and also from IRIB English Radio staff to you, Jayanta Chakrabarty from India." Thank you very much for this great email and appreciations to you for letting us know your opinion about the quality of our programs as you spoke about the quality of the program, the signal strength, and the presentation of the program. Thank you for that. Your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio let us move easily and truly in our paths to strengthen the quality of our programs. Thank you for that. It is a pleasure to have you with us as a long-time regular listener of IRIB English Radio. Jayanta Chakrabarty from India, thank you again. Please accept our electronic QSL as verification. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Now, here we have an email from Poland, from Tomasz Katas. Tomasz says, dear friends at IRIB English Radio, my name is Tomasz Katas, a DXer from Poland. Thank you for taking the time to read my report. I hope you found it useful. If this reception report is accurate and you have the time, please verify it with an EQSL email confirmation. Thank you. Salam and greetings to you, Tomasz Katas from Poland. Thank you for this email. So, you are a DXer from Poland. Thank you for taking time to write this email to IRIB English Radio. We will soon send you an EQSL or electronic QSL as confirmation. So, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. Okay, as I always say, art is long, but life is short. Yes, here we have come to the end of our today's listeners special. Many thanks for being with us. Please keep in touch with IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. All human blood may be red from a physiological perspective, but in the United Kingdom, blue blood rules. The coronation of King Charles III is living proof of that, as it took place on Saturday with much pomp and circumstances and a £250 million price tag for the British public. In a country where the quality of life continues to deteriorate for the average Brit, it becomes more obvious that the pomp is for a privileged few and pressure for the majority. Well, I'd like to talk about all of this on this spotlight. Welcome my guests to the program. Linda Delpick, former member of British Parliament, out of London. And Nick Napier, activist and commentator out of Edinburgh. Thank you both for being with us. Well, actually, you're in Seattle, I guess. So, okay, I saw something else up there. You're in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What does it mean, Limbit, to have a hereditary monarchy in the 21st century?
First of all, apologies for the very poor sound. I couldn't make my normal hands-free work. In terms of your question, it means that a majority of people in the United Kingdom still do seem to support the monarchy, but the monarchy has to justify itself economically now. As you said in your introduction, Britain is a poor country. Relatively speaking now, it has huge economic problems. And the hundreds of millions that this coronation has cost really needs to be repaid, at least in terms of tourism by the royal family. But more than that, my biggest concern is that the government doesn't understand the contradiction. I don't really blame King Charles for the stupid economic decisions made by prime ministers. King Charles wasn't elected, he's a hereditary head of state. But the politicians should at least have explained why it's okay to spend this enormous amount on the monarchy rather than simply trying to suppress opposition. I think it's legitimate, regardless of my own views, legitimate to be a Republican, but you shouldn't have to justify yourself or get arrested for having taken that position. So fundamentally, it's the politicians rather than the royalty that I blame the pressures that you rightly outlined in your introduction.
Okay. Well, Mick, your perspective and your belief system in dealing with this hereditary monarchy in the 21st century, when it's a country that always lectures others about equality, human rights, I mean, your overall assessment, Mick.
Well, I agree with the great British political revolutionary of a couple of hundred years ago. It was very influential in America and France. Tom Paine, who said it was as ludicrous to have a hereditary head of state as to have a hereditary carpenter or plumber, or he would say today, IT technician. It makes no sense, but it makes sense in one way. If we look at the three elements of the British state, the House of Commons is elected, the second chamber is unelected, and the monarchy, of course, by definition, is unelected. So there are large parts of the state which are not open to the will of the people. And although the demonstrations in London today and elsewhere, I haven't kept up with them, were quite modest, it's difficult to tell what percentage of the population sympathises with them. I mean, when I was younger, it used to be in every cinema, in a time when cinemas were the main method of public entertainment, that people were expected to stand at the end of the evening's performance for the national anthem. Well, because nobody stood but rushed for the exits, that particular institution was retired because there was no support for it. It's difficult to know what the support for the monarchy is in any real sense. You can measure numbers, and older people tend to be much more conservative and much more pro-monarchy. Among young people, it's a very different story. Mm-hmm. And the last numbers I read were that 40% of people under the age of 25 preferred a monarchy and something very similar preferred a republic and something very similar for those under 35. So it's difficult to measure. It's also difficult to measure because although our fellow guest says it's not illegal to be a Republican, it's certainly disparaged in the mainstream media. We learned a few days ago that the BBC, in its meticulous and expensive publicly financed preparation to cover the coronation, actually puts its footage to the palace, first of all, for its agreement. So in a very real sense, the chunk of the population who are Republican in sympathy, or the equally large proportion who don't care and don't support the monarchy, okay, their views are filtered out.
Well, Limbitt, pro-royalists, when answering critics, say that the Queen, or now the King, is mostly a ceremonial role. How can that be said when technically he can appoint and dismiss ministers and even declare war?
Good question. And it's down to the behaviour of the royal family. Now, I won't give you a history lesson in British monarchy, but hundreds of years ago, one member of the royal family, one king, ended up in huge trouble for trying to push Parliament around. Different politicians and different monarchs get on to different degrees. And the big question isn't so much the constitutional position, because as you've just heard, it is theoretically a ceremonial position. It's the extent to which the monarchy seeks to influence Parliament. But here it gets complicated. With a good political system, with a good Prime Minister, with a good Parliament, everything's beautiful. It works well. The monarchy perhaps is a nice adornment, a nice, beautiful thing to look at, something that brings tourists to the UK. But if the government is weak, the monarchy becomes more powerful. And that's what ironically provokes republicanism and makes it harder for the monarchy to justify itself. But that's because the elected politicians aren't doing their job. I actually think that's the situation we're in now.
Well, Mick, with rising food prices, rents, and much pressure on the National Health Service, NHS, do you think the average British citizen benefits from the presence of the monarchy in general?
It's very patchy. I just saw the much-hyped call to come together in the main square of Glasgow, my native city, to celebrate the monarchy and even to take a vow of allegiance. And the square was empty. There was a huge big screen available for anyone who wanted to participate, but people had voted with their feet or actually by not using their feet. So given that today we have millions of people relying on food banks, that most people have a very genuine sense that the much-loved National Health Service, one of the gems of British culture, is in danger and is being whittled away government after government. The fact that when, you know, people who are now in the internet economy actually delivering goods around the country earn such low wages that they have to drive dangerously in order to make a living. And, you know, my daughter lives in Berlin and lives quite well in terms of being young, but being able to rent a house where the rent controls are very, very significant. Young people in Britain are finding it impossible to live, certainly to buy a property, but to pay rent, which doesn't reduce them to dire straits. So life is hard. And in that situation, the monarchy is an institution of the state, and the views of millions and millions of people intersect in the person of that monarch. Some support it, some despise it. But at the moment, there's a widespread sense among the experts, and in fact, John Curtis from Strathclyde University is widely seen as the leading pollster in the country. He's saying that there's still a majority for the monarchy, but really it needs support because the support is ebbing away, especially among young people.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Limbit, in a country where basic staples have skyrocketed and 1 in 10 kids are facing poverty and even working people, such as teachers, where 1 in 5 are experiencing food poverty, in general, why would so much money be spent for the royal family? And a lot of it, especially if what we saw today, again, being funded by the working class. It just seems, where's the equity in all of this?
Well, there is no equity in it. The difference between the richest 5% and the poorest 5% in the United Kingdom is horrendous. In many ways, we're like a third world economy where if you've got it, you can get richer. If you haven't got it, you can't even afford to pay your rent, as my colleague has just said. But there's a different question to ask here. Does the royal family do more good than harm? Now, I have to say that in terms of the opinion polls, my personal view is that most people in politics in Britain do still feel that the monarchy is relevant and they want it. One of the ironies is that oftentimes the Queen was preferred as the person to run the country more than the Prime Minister. And then I move to my second and perhaps the central point here. The lack of equity isn't because the royal family have made stupid mistakes in government policy. It's because the government has made stupid mistakes in government policy. If the UK really was a superbly wealthy country, then actually the royal family, even if it was making a slight loss, is an affordable luxury. I suspect the royal family does make quite a lot of money in terms of economic turnover. But fundamentally, the problem is the argument has not been made satisfactorily by politicians. And what I think we now see is a potentially popular King Charles III and a potentially extremely unpopular political situation where the Labour Party and the Conservatives, the two main parties, simply aren't talking to the country. And here's the biggest irony. Imagine if I'm right. Imagine if King Charles III becomes a more attractive leader of this country than the people that we elect. So, yes, it's expensive, but it's far more expensive to the UK if the public preferred the unelected royalty than the elected government.
Well, it's interesting what you said, Limpet, because it already appears that Charles doesn't have a whole lot of charisma. I mean, because when talking or looking at people's statements, our correspondents on the ground there, there were positive said, more positive said about the Queen, of course, in her 70-year reign, and there was a bit of a reassurance perhaps given by her. And she stayed, for the most part, tried to stay out of controversial domestic matters, whereas Charles, even as prince, was not so successful. So it doesn't seem that he's going to have a whole lot of charisma during his reign. I mean, your take. Go ahead.
I've been lucky to meet him a few times. Actually, at a personal level, I have to tell you, I've just got to tell you the truth. He is charismatic.
Okay.
He's likable. He's quite charming and he's very funny, but he's also quite political. The Queen, especially on things like the environment, the Queen was careful not to be quoted in public. Sometimes she was, and that caused anger to the royal family and to the advisors. But she had 70 years to build her popularity. King Charles has only had one, and let's remember that the royal family under the Queen about 20, 30 years ago was really unpopular. when Princess Diana died in that terrible car crash in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem for King Charles is he is not the master of his own destiny. How the public feel about the interrelationship between the head of state and the head of government, that's a really big factor. Can King Charles be as popular as the Queen? Maybe, but he won't have 70 years to do it. I watch with interest what he does. I want him to do well. The Queen did, I think, very well in her role. King Charles didn't choose to be born into the royal family, and he has got a duty of care for what his responsibilities are. Maybe others say that we will become a republic. I don't think that's going to happen soon. And therefore, if I was King Charles, the next time I met the Prime Minister, I would say, you've got to do a good job so that I don't get the rep for your bad behaviour, because I can't come into the Commons, knock on the door and take over, even if I'd like to.
Right. Well, he didn't choose to be a king or part of the royal family, but, you know, £250 million worth personal fortune of £1.8 billion. It's not a bad position to be in for him, I'm sure. Well, Mick, overall, I mean, we've talked about the stark contrast between the older and younger Brits and the existence of the monarchy in general. And today, with the coronation taking place, there were protests and chants of "Not my king." Do you see the role of the royal crown diminishing in the future, or your overall assessment?
Well, we have to define what the role of the monarchy is, and I think it's overwhelmingly symbolic. It's a symbol of grotesque privilege, lording it over great poverty and great lack of security. I mean, there is a political element here of real power. There was I can't remember the year, but an Australian government was dismissed by the Queen's representative, the government, the Governor General, and she dismissed a left-wing government and opened up the road for a right-wing government to replace it. And Australians remember this very, very well. So although the powers are residual, they remain real in periods of crisis. Lembit mentioned the situation when Princess Diana died. It wasn't a political crisis, but it was a profound crisis for the royal family. They trembled in their palace because a spasm of powerful emotion went round the country, which measured Princess Diana very favourably against the rest of them. And that crisis it's essentially a corporation, the royal family, but that crisis inside the people who managed that corporation was very profound and very real, and they managed to ride the wave of rage and anger, but it might have been quite a close-run thing. But the main thing about the monarch is it symbolises privilege, it symbolises inherited wealth, it symbolises the domination of people who may lack any quality, any redeeming quality, but who solely by virtue of the bed into which they are born becomes head of state or become a group of royals who have a huge, huge silver spoon in their mouth. So it's that grotesque endorsement of inequality which I think rankles with millions of British people today. Difficult to tell how it will take shape, how the Republican movement will develop, but I think John Curtis is right. Although there remains a majority for as measured by pollsters, the foundations look increasingly shaky, and unless there's action taken to strengthen them, then I think the future looks challenging for the House of Windsor.
Okay. Well, I'd love to continue this conversation, but unfortunately we got started a little late because of some technical issues. I appreciate both of you being with me. Lembit Opik, former member of the British Parliament out of London, and Mick Napier, activist and commentator of ITMR. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every every day on IRIB English Radio.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan. La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Color of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the events that took place on Laylatul Mabit. What was Laylatul Mabit? What exactly took place? What was the exact date and place? And why this event is significant in the history of Islam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that when the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family was chosen as the last prophet, he tried to invite the people of Mecca toward the religion of Islam for about 13 years.
And
the Holy Prophet and the companions of the Prophet were suffering a lot from the persecution of the polities of the city of Mecca. And we know that in the fifth year after Hijra, a group of Muslims, because of such pressure, they went to Abyssinia for some years. We know about what happened in Shi'ab Abi Talib, that valley. And finally, we know that the nobles and the elders of the Quraysh tribe decided to kill the Prophet. And put an scheme to choose one person from each tribe, and all of them together kill the Holy Prophet, so that the tribe of Banu Hashim would not be able to fight all of them and be happy for receiving the money, the blood money.
And also none of them will be guilty.
Exactly.
Solely, that's right. Okay.
Now, the Holy Prophet was informed of this incident, and as instructed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He decided to begin his journey from Mecca to Medina, which is known as the Hijra, the migration of the Prophet from Mecca to Medina. Now, on that very night,
which night is the month and night clear?
Yeah, according to some historical books, the night of Laylatul Mabit, the night of that event, is on the first night of the month of Rabiul Awwal in the 13th or 14th year after the mission of the Prophet.
Okay.
Now, on that very night, all these polities, according to some narrations, 40 people, they gathered around the house of the Holy Prophet, and they decided to kill him early in the morning. Now, the Holy Prophet was inside the house, and he was in need of, a plan to get rid of these polytheists. So he asked Imam Ali alayhi salam to lie and sleep in his bed. And according to some narrations, in a miraculous way, he was able to go out of his house and to continue his journey toward the Cave of Thawr, and finally to go to the city of Medina.
All these cases are by the plan of Prophet or no, by the order of Allah? Or
everything
something?
Was mentioned to him by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of course.
Okay, that's right, okay.
Now, this is a very special night in the history of Islam because, I mean, it was very likely for the Prophet to be killed.
Yes.
So everything was about to just be finished by killing the Prophet. Now, this is the time